Welcome to the Tortured Talking Poets Podcast Department. I am your host, Charlie Green. Sometimes I produce short episodes where it's just me, and on episodes like today's, I invite a guest to bring in any poem they'd like to talk about for any reason. We'll follow the poem and the conversation wherever they go, and after that, we'll have a little silliness. If you do enjoy the show, please follow and rate it wherever you get your podcasts. Today, I am so happy to have as my guest Lisa Ampleman. She is the author of 3 full-length collections of poems, most recent being Mom in Space. Oh, I'm sorry. I think I may have mispronounced that.
Mom in Space.
So Mom in Space came out in January from LSU Press, timed to come out before the solar eclipse. She timed the eclipse to with her book. She is the managing editor of One of My Old Haunts, the Cincinnati Review, and is the poetry series editor at Acre Books. Lisa, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. It's good to converse again.
Yeah. And a little visual description that you are sitting in front of a wall that looks to be painted or just covered entirely in an image of Earth from the moon.
It's wallpaper. You can still buy this online. I was surprised when I looked it up. It's a view of the Taurus Litro Mountains, I think from Apollo 17. And the Earth is a lot bigger than it really is in real life from the moon, but it's beautiful nonetheless.
If I can find a link, I'll share it in the show notes.
Yeah, I can send you one.
So before we get to the poem you've brought in, I'm just actually curious, you've got your NASA shirt on as well. You gave a reading at the Cincinnati Observatory. I'm just curious how space became so central to your collection. Clearly there's an interest, I think, pre or outside of the poetry, but.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think it's the book would not have happened without some of the experiences I'm about to describe. So I was not a space nut when I was a kid. I was an adult in my late 30s, and the Cincinnati Museum Center had an exhibit as part of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, and they had on display the Apollo 11 command module while the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum was closed for renovations. So I got to go to that exhibit, you know, just a couple months after seeing some of the anniversary documentaries. And I realized there was so much that I didn't know. There was a handwritten note there from Neil Armstrong, who actually retired to Cincinnati, and he grew up just north of here, about 2 hours north. I just wanted to learn more. And I saw that one of the books in the gift shop was Man on the Moon by Andrew Chaikin. And I was headed to a residency. So I took the book with me. And it was like a narrative. And I realized that, you know, we all know about Neil Armstrong, first step on the moon, but there was so much more of the history I didn't know. And reading that book felt like reading a narrative, and I wanted to know what came next. So I requested a bunch of books from the library on Space Lab and the space station and Mir and the space shuttle, and they all came back, and I was able to getting ready to read them, and it was March 2020. And we all started spending a lot of time at home. So I had a lot of time to read. And I just became more and more fascinated. I think some of it was a way of escape due to those particular circumstances. I also think some of it is just like awe and wonder. And the more I read about science, it's, you know, just something to be curious about and learn about that in a way that I really enjoy.
In junior high, we went to space camp on a field trip in Huntsville, Alabama, and I was too in my head about other things because I'd skipped a grade and I was younger than everybody. And also twice when I was seated completely on the ground, they managed to make my fear of heights come out very intensely. Once was watching something on an IMAX screen, and another time was sitting in a sort of fake rover that's mimicking the movement of a shuttle and then crash lands. So,
oh my
yeah,
gosh.
Was not a fan of that. But we'll come back to Earth with Jory Graham's poem that you brought in, The Way Things Work. Mm-hmm. And I'll just ask you to go ahead and read it, and then we'll talk about it.
Sounds great. I should say before I start reading that the title goes right into the poem. The first letter is lowercase. The way things work is by admitting or opening a way. This is the simplest form of current. Blue moving through blue, blue through purple, the objects of desire opening upon themselves without us, the objects of faith. The way things work is by solution, resistance lessened or increased and taken advantage of. The way things work is that we finally believe they are there, common and able to illustrate themselves. Wheel, kinetic flow, rising and falling water, ingots, levers and keys, I believe in you, cylinder lock, pulley, lifting tackle, and crane, lift your small head. I believe in you. Your head is the horizon to my hand. I believe forever in the hooks. The way things work is that eventually something catches.
Thank you so much. Why did you choose this poem?
When people ask me who my favorite poet is, it's hard to pick, let's be honest. But about, 15 years ago, I would easily say Jorie Graham. I encountered her work most fully in a graduate level class on the meditative mode. And there's something that just melds really well with the way that I think and the way that she establishes the poem. I actually studied her a little bit for my master's exams. And one of the things I looked at specifically was the gerund, the ing verb. You can see it even in the first few lines here, admitting and opening away. And when there's so much of that in a poem or in a work of poems, it definitely evokes a current moment and like the thought that's happening in that moment, experiencing it all almost like slow-mo for like a visual comparison. And so even when I was pulling out this book to think about our conversation today, I just got excited all over again about poetry. I think that's what she does for me, because the meditations are in that current moment, as much poetry tries to be. It tries to get our attention and like pay attention to this thing happening. And so her poems enacting that just made me excited about it all over again. So the poem is from her first book, which is called Hybrids of Plants and Ghosts from 1980. And it was with Princeton University Press. So it's the first poem in that book, and it's the first poem in her Pulitzer Prize winning selected poems, which is called The Dream of the Unified Field, which is the first book of hers that I read. And, her work changes over time after this book. The lines get longer and longer. The page gets wider and wider. It happens a lot more often now, but it used to be the Jorie Graham treatment. If you got an extra piece of paper folded over in like poetry magazine so that your poem fit on the page, where it was turned broadside. So I think her work also gets progressively difficult. I just use scare quotes in the air because I think that means different things for different people. Especially very focused on climate. I know her latest book, To 2040, is very climate focused. So I've been interested in kind of like the span of her career, and this is like the first poem ever, in a book form that she put out. I have other kind of things I'm interested about it, but that's definitely perhaps a place to stop.
I'm going to come at this from an odd angle, because I've read Jorie Graham poems over the years. I've just never really been touched by one. I've never read one and thought, I need to read more Jorie Graham. And I think part of it is that her poems are often a lot more abstract than I tend to grab onto. And I was ready for my first question to be, or my first comment to say, I need to be sold on the poem. But the more that I've read it, the more I appreciate it. I still don't feel like that kind of electricity when a poem just really wows you. So I'm curious to hear you, if possible, with great phrase for poetry, what's the sales pitch for this poem?
Sure. And first of all, you're definitely, I have the same read, like it's abstract in a certain way. And so it's broad. And so the reader can read into it all sorts of things. So, there were times of my life where I read this poem and I saw the things working or not working as relationship or romance or things like that. And then I think I'll probably talk more about this a little bit later in our conversation. But when I was trying to get pregnant and have a kid, that also kind of stuck in my head as like the way things work. But for a sales pitch, beyond you can read whatever into it that you want kind of thing, I admire how in some ways it's literally about how things work. There's physics and chemistry in here. And there's almost like a Rube Goldberg partway through the wheel, kinetic flow, rising and falling water, ingots, levers, and keys, cylinder lock, pulley, lifting tackle, and crane. My son was studying Rube Goldberg projects at school. I just remembered all over again how cool that is to see things interacting with each other. And I'm not an expert in physics or chemistry by any means, but that way of like things not working and then they are working is something that I'm very interested in. And I'm also very interested in the syntax. So there's really like kind of three ways the sentences get formed as far as syntax goes. There's the way things work, which comes up as a marker 1, 2, 3, 4 times. There's the oddball. This is the simplest form of current, which is kind of the second sentence beginning. And then there's the description of the Rube Goldberg. And then 2, I believe in yous. So it's also, I think, in some ways about having faith in objects as well as in ourselves and the relationships we have, because there's that, I believe in you, your head is the horizon to my hand, which could be, you know, the crane in the previous sentence, or it could be something else entirely, another person.
Well, I'm glad you drew attention to the I believe in you. We also get I believe in you. We get that twice, and then I believe forever in the hooks. And as I was rereading the poem, I think that's what really was ended up being my way into the poem. Because I think the things, other than the abstraction, what I resisted is, and this is a pet peeve, it's not fair to the poem, I have a thing about the word thing.
Yeah.
About it, wanting it to be something more specific, wanting it to be more evocative. But I think the reason that ultimately it works in the poem is that it's a poem about having faith in something without knowing how it works or why. And at first, the poem, on first read, it sounds, the voice sounds very confident because the way things work is, and everything is explained as if the speaker totally understands, but the explanations don't make a lot of sense. In a way, it becomes, I end up taking it as the speaker just trying to restate for herself something eventually something catches. And so I think I didn't pick up on the tension between the certainty and the real doubt that I think really drives the poem.
Yes, definitely. And I think that as you read it, you can definitely see it as, you know, someone who has that confident voice, the way things work. This is how they work. But clearly by the time you get to the end, it's eventually something catches. What does that mean? Something wasn't catching before? And that kind of changes my view for sure of that voice. And that's the part of the poem that sticks with me longer than anything else. Some of it is that rhythm of syntax. And then those last three lines have just stuck in my head since, you know, almost 20 years now.
The way the last sentence is crafted, I love the line break after eventually. The way things work is that eventually something catches. And it allows you to hear both the hope and the sort of doubt that the hope is reacting to. There's still a part of me that kind of wants the poem to have something that it's attaching to in terms of the concrete or the specific.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's why, that may be why I'm not attaching to it. And that's just my preference for poems. I want them to take me into another situation. And I find like part of it is the second line, the way things work is by admitting or opening a way. Opening away is such a strange phrase, and it's the sort of thing, I want to see its strangeness in a situation.
Yeah.
And so I admire the oddity of the situation, and I find myself wanting, and again, I think this is just my preference as much as anything else, because a lot of people love Jory Graham, and I think that sometimes there are poets that for whatever reason don't click with you, and then like 10 years later they do. Yeah. I have this feeling because I kept warming up to this poem, that over time, something is going to click and Jory Graham is going to start to like, I'm going to be on the wavelength of it, basically.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, this poem of hers is somewhat representative of her oeuvre, if that's how you pronounce that. But, you know, she has other poems that are about very specific scenes. She has one about breakdancing and St. Teresa, one about a boy taking a speaker out to see 500 B-52s on alert on the runway, fully loaded, fully manned, running every minute of the day. So there are definitely places where the poet, then the poem, get more into a scene and a setting. And I think that, you know, the poem, the most specific parts are the kind of what I've referred to as the Rube Goldberg, where it's a list of specific kinds of things that work together to make something work. And it's funny because, you know, again, like when people would ask me my favorite poet, right behind Jory Graham, I would say Lucy Brock Broido, who is exactly the opposite and uses incredibly specific diction for things. So, yeah, I understand that completely. That's what I admire when I'm reading poetry, too. So it's funny. I'm not a poet like Jory Graham, and I like a lot of things that aren't like her. It's funny how that can happen as a reader.
You know, I will say this is reminiscing for me, but this is present for you. When we were going through manuscripts at the Cincinnati Review, there was an emphasis on breadth, that you're not trying to anchor everything around your own preferences. And so in every issue, there ended up being a really broad range. And so I love that you've got Lucy Brock Broido along with Jory Graham. That's a fascinating pairing. I want to tell you my favorite thing in the poem, because I keep coming back to it. It's another moment that sort of reinforces the belief, and I'm just curious to hear you talk about it. It's that the objects of desire opening upon themselves without us, the objects of faith. I love the echo of objects of desire, objects of faith. I'm just curious to hear you talk about how you read that.
One thing I think about right away, something that you said that chimed with me earlier, I am a person of faith. And as part of that, I think doubt is based on the people I know who I've interacted with quite a lot who have a deep faith. Doubt is an element of that. I know people were shocked when it came out that Mother Teresa, for example, had doubts sometimes. And I was like, of course she did. I mean, that's part, like, faith. If you were certain, it wouldn't be faith, it would be certainty. So I had that thought, which isn't specifically about this. But so this is the simplest form of current, blue moving through blue, blue through purple, the objects of desire opening upon themselves without us. I almost think of flowers opening up to themselves, or if you think of the object of desire as a person kind of opening within themselves, but not to us. So it's something that's not available to us either way. And so it's something, therefore, that we have to have faith in, which comes back to the way things work. We don't see it working all the time. We have to believe that it's working.
Then the objects of desire, their value does not center around the desirer. And that it's a really fascinating way to think of faith. I was really glad to hear you talk about, like, doubt being an essential part of faith, that the thing is there, whether you accept it or believe in it or not. Is sort of the idea here, the object of desire, it has its own intrinsic value that is not related to your desiring it at all. And so I actually like the poem, the way it reminds me of that kind of detachment from the thing itself. And because it's another way in which things work.
Yes.
That they work on their own. There is the interconnectedness that the poem does get to with, I love the phrase, the Rube Goldberg. Because I love Rube Goldberg machines. I can watch several of those in a row on YouTube and realize I've lost an hour or two.
Uh-huh.
So are there other things it's a short poem. I mean, there's lots to say about it, but I think it's relative brevity and also keeping an eye on the clock, because in a moment we'll get to a poem of yours. But is there anything else you want to say about this poem or ask, make me have to talk about with the poem, since I came in with doubt about the poem at first?
I mean, I think you're allowed not to be fully believing of the poem if we're going to continue the faith metaphor. And I think, I'm actually thinking about what would be a good bridge to what we'll probably talk about with my poem, which is that the phrase, the way things work is that eventually something catches, came to me again and again in different times of my life when I was experiencing infertility, which is such a clinical and law word. I don't like using it, but there's no synonyms that kind of capture it. So trying to have a child and failing and kind of the complex emotions around that, I had to believe in myself almost that the way things work is that eventually something will catch. And, Jory Graham doesn't have a lot of super personal poems, although her latest poems talk about being a grandmother very specifically, which is kind of interesting. But she does have a poem in her second book called Wanting a Child. And so just both of those two make me think about what doesn't work and what we don't talk about that's not working. And so sometimes, obviously, that's relationships. Sometimes it's other kinds of things. And, for infertility, I've been thinking about, it was something that I kind of held in myself for a long time because it's not something we talk about widely, whether it's we don't want to set up the people we love for sorrow when it doesn't work out, or because it's related to sex and the body, or because it's women's work in a way. It's just not a very common subject. I think it's becoming more so. I think it's more in the news and more women and women identifying people are, you know, talking about their experiences. But it's still kind of on the edge of not taboo, but something not spoken. And so, you know, I did come back to the ending of that poem again and again. You know, the way things work is that eventually something catches. Not quite a mantra. It didn't come up that often in my head.
I'm glad you talked about it in terms of, thank you for being so open about talking about infertility, because it's, I feel like the idea that the value of women for a lot of people in our culture still attaches to reproduction. And a lot, what's funny is along with a lot of the attempts to roll back freedom of choice, you know, people have said, you know, this is going to come back even further than you expect. There are going to be people who are saying IVF shouldn't happen, that that's somehow should be illegal. And there were plenty of people who said, oh, no, that won't happen. And then a House member, I can't remember which state, is like, yeah, we need to roll back this IVF. And it was just like, there is a sort of reactionary response to like what they see as unnatural, even though it is, in fact, I think a blessing and a joy, and you know that possibility is there. But it, yeah, you're absolutely right. The people I don't think are comfortable talking about it for any number of reasons. So, well, let's turn over to your poem, which I will go ahead and say was delighted by. Sell me on this poem. I just immediately loved it. So,
well, I'm glad to hear that. So, do you want me to say a little bit about it before I read it?
Go ahead and read it, and then you can say whatever you'd like. Just so people can hear it, and then I'll try not to ask you 20-minute long questions like it's the Q&A of a reading. So,
sounds good. All right. So this is Tenuous Blueprint, and it was first published in the Passenger's Journal. You will recognize the epigraph. The way things work is that eventually something catches. Jory Graham. Tenuous Blueprint. Speck of a specimen, mite of a maybe, iota of an outline. Every nucleotide ready to sequence and seam, to grow something or power it off, certified and approved, curled in double helix, your start and perhaps your end encoded in the jumble of enzymes. Phoneme, syllable, syntax, the advance is staggering. Split and multiply cells. Poppy seed, peppercorn, blueberry, mystical sewing kit, and the garment itself to be worn. Whatever you do, keep dividing, keep reconnecting, heart, hip joint, cheek.
Thank you. So what do you have, like a spiel you give about the poem, or you just want to talk a little bit about the process of writing it?
Sure, I can give a little spiel. So, you know, a lot of, as you would guess from what I said earlier, a lot of the poems in the book, or especially in the first part of this book, Mom in Space, talk about the challenge of having a child, or also secondary infertility, where you've had a successful pregnancy and then you have a struggle. And so when I was at that residency where I was reading Man on the Moon by Andrew Chaikin, just before the COVID pandemic hit here, I thought to myself, I'll try a sonnet. That seems kind of like something to work toward. And so there is a rhyme scheme for this. It's not pentameter or anything like that. I've also, you know, I had in mind when I was pregnant that the DNA, it obviously carries genetic elements that lead to how things develop, the way things work, maybe, if you will. But sometimes within that genetic code is something that may lead to, you know, the embryo or fetus not surviving because a code is missing, or it's developed in a different way, or et cetera. Or, you know, the adult, you know, certain kinds of genes lead to terminal conditions. And so that was something that definitely stuck with me. And I wanted to try and to do something that was a sonnet that had a rhyme scheme. There's no pentameter that kind of talked about that idea and the awe of it, and also with some intensity of sound. And that's, you know, assonance is one of my favorite poetic tools, if you will. So assonance and the alliteration and all of that, all of those things kind of come together with how I worked on this one.
That's one of the things I love. I knew as soon as I read the first line that I would love it. Speck of a specimen, mite of a maybe. Like, you're clearly engaged in sound. What's interesting about the poem, or one of the things, is that you have the Jory Graham as an epigraph, And this poem is so, so different than the way things work. There's such an emphasis on richness of sound. It's a very, very different kind of vocabulary. And I love the idea is linked in that sense that you know, that feeling of hope that eventually something catches and that everything feels so delicate. And I think the choice of a sonnet without pentameter actually makes sense. Like, you're hoping for a kind of form to come together.
Yeah.
And the rhymes are great. Maybe in seam, nucleotide certified. I'm just, I'm a fan of the poem. So it's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you. One thing I forgot to mention when I first started talking about the poem is that the title itself is thanks to a prompt from the Passenger's journal editor, Andrea Kapolinsky, who I can't remember what the title was before, but it just wasn't as evocative. And so the idea of that delicateness, the tenuousness, was something I was able to get to because of what Andrea recommended thinking about as they were accepting the poem.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I love the title too. So, and I love that, I don't know, I'm turning into a fanboy for the poem a little bit, but I love that where the poem ends gets closer to the Jory Graham, that we've had this richness of language, richness of vocabulary, and the language at the end simplifies. Whatever you do, keep dividing, keep reconnecting heart, hip, joint, cheek. And that simplicity, I feel like, really is it's a nice turn and surprise in the poem. So
no, thanks.
Not that my praise is the object of desire being the poem. My praise is no intrinsic value to it. So before we get to the game, if you're ready for the silliness, we do have an ad. So Lisa, would you call yourself a Swiftie?
Oh, I am ashamed to say that I am not. I missed the boat, but I know a lot of people who are. I think even my son might be a little bit, but I'm willing to be sold. Sell me.
Oh, I don't know if I'll be selling you on that. I'm not myself a Swiftie. I have thawed and warmed up to Taylor Swift over time, but I'm happy to say that this podcast, the Talking Poem Podcast, has a unique promotional tie-in with Taylor Swift's new double album, the Tortured Poets Department. With her permission, we're re-releasing her albums with an emphasis on poetry. From her first album, you can hear the Robert Lowell-inspired Tim McGraw and the Cooked. But it really picks up with her second album, Fearlessly Marmon Silko. You'll love such poetic remixes from her third album, Speak Now. It's like, I shall forget you presently, my dear John. But is the John of the title Mayer, Keats, Berryman, or Dunn? Which, by the way, the Talking Poem Podcast is represented by the law firm of Keats, Berryman, and Dunn. Please direct all cease and desist letters to them. Then we follow Taylor Swift's turn to mainstream pop music with her album Color Reg, Samuel Taylor's version. The hits keep coming with 22 Tramps in Mud Time and We Are Never Ever Getting Back to Heather McHugh. After that, Naomi Shihab 1989, featuring Welcome to the New York School and Mom in Blank Space. So,
love it.
She's a fan. And yes, we're still going with Taylor Swift's first critical miss, her album Reputation, and its single, You Do Not Do, Look What You Made Me Do. Then up to Paul Lover Lane, and the singles April is the Cruelest Cruel Summer and The Man, Lee Hopkins. After that album, Folk Lord Byron and the hit song You know a pun is working when you have to explain it for listeners or for myself. We have her tribute album to one of our former podcast guests, Rebecca Evermorgan Frank. And finally, her final album, Pre-Tortured Poets Department, Midnights, with its singles Anti-Hero and Leander and William Karma Williams. So please, for the love of all that is holy, please send me money or I'll keep making Taylor Swift puns. So there you go. There you have it. And I'm on to a game.
I love it. Keeping
with the space theme that I'm calling My Very Elegant Mother Just Sat Upon Nine Porcupines. It's a mnemonic for the planets in our solar system, including the since-removed Pluto. And I'm including it because it was a planet when I was in school, and we all know what we learned in school is forever how the world works. So in this game, I'm going to read you a short excerpt from a poem, and you have to tell me which of those nine planets it's describing.
I love this.
The look on your face is fantastic. The five questions, they start easy and they get more difficult as we go. Lisa Ampleman, author of Mom in Space, are you ready to play My Very Elegant Mother Just Sat Upon 9 Porcupines?
Yes.
Okay. Number one. Today, I broke your solar system. Oops, my bad. Your graph said I was supposed to make a nice little loop around the sun.
Oh my gosh. I might need to hear it again. My brain was doing that, but this was like alternative Taylor Swift, which isn't true.
Yeah, that's the real purpose of the ad, is to throw the guests so much that they do poorly on the quiz,
yeah,
or on the game.
All right.
Today, okay. I broke your solar system. Oops, my bad. Your graph said I was supposed to make a nice little loop around the sun.
I mean, Pluto doesn't make a really nice move around the sun, but I don't know if that's the answer.
Are you going to stick with that as your final answer?
I'll stick with it. Why not? You can tell me.
Ding, ding, ding. It is Pluto. Yes. This is from Fatima Ashgar's Pluto Shits on the Universe. I also want to call out Fatima Ashgar's fantastic Instagram and Twitter handle, Ashgar the Grouch. Number two, and I should say that some of these don't make a ton of syntactical sense because I had to take them out of context to not give everything away. As gazes tilt away from your lip, a glint, the flashbulb rings of blank, seen through a lens, its ice flying apart. There sit the rings.
Ooh, so there are two planets that have rings, both Saturn and Uranus. Well, maybe Neptune does too. But the one that's most widely known is Saturn, so I think I'll probably stick with Saturn.
Ding, ding, ding. From UC alum and former guest Cynthia Arya King's Ming the Clam. By the way, speaking of rings, I learned the other day that there are some rings around Jupiter which Voyager, I think it's Voyager 1 and 2, discovered. Voyager 1 is still going, apparently.
It is,
and
yeah.
They had lost communication with it, and they managed to do a sort of code-based workaround. So they're still getting, it's amazing. It's so far from here.
Yeah.
As somebody who, it took a couple extra years to learn to tie his shoes, I feel totally in awe of people who could, of the work that has gone into making that a possibility. Number three, last weekend I saw blank through a giant telescope, its storm stripes, four of its 67 moons, and was filled with fierce longing, bitter that instead of Ganymede or Europa, I had only one moon floating in my sky.
Jupiter.
That is Jupiter. It is. I meant to make that first, because it's pretty obvious with the mentioning the moons. This is Catherine Pierce's planet. You're three for three so far. There are two more. Can we sweep this? The pearl starts over a new grain of sand. We are going to find in the planet of blue a freshly written eviction note.
I'm picturing them. You know, I always mix up Neptune and Uranus, but I'm going to say Neptune.
I'm afraid it is also Pluto.
Oh, the planet of blue.
Yeah, it's the
okay.
The planet of blue doesn't make total sense, but the freshly written eviction note I really like.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's C. Conrad's Pluto.1. And finally, number five, here we go. They say that planet is torment, whipped by circular wind, choked in vitriol clouds. But no, when you get there, it is a light in the sky, and I am with you.
The weather described seems kind of Venus-y. Light in the sky. Yeah, I'm going to go with Venus.
It is Venus. Poem titled Venus by Dean Nersky. You got four out of five. One of them was a real curveball.
Yeah.
Is Pluto blue? It's not blue that I can tell.
No, I mean, I don't know if the poem was written when we had our most recent pictures, but it's kind of like icy whitey with some red, weirdly enough.
Wow.
And it has this like white heart on it in frost.
Oh, that's so cool. I'm going to go find those pictures because I don't recall seeing them. I was very excited about all the Webb telescope pictures, which were fantastic.
Yeah.
Lisa, thank you so much for being here. Is there anything you want to say or plug before we go?
I want to say thank you for the podcast and for the invitation, because it's so nice to hear conversations about poetry when I'm like going about my daily life, putting away the dishes and things like that. So thank you for the work you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you. The money is being Venmo'd to you as we speak. Pretty much. As always, thanks for listening. Go have a great day, read some poems, pet some dogs, and support striking workers wherever you find them. Bye.